Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, June 12th, 2013. Ed Snowden is discovering that it's a pretty small, small world.
There is just one moon and one golden sun, and a smile means friendship to everyone. Though the mountains divide and the oceans are wide, it's a small world.
Ed Snowden on the lam, the most sought-after fugitive in the world today, is still saying he's hiding out in Hong Kong. Now, he checked out of his hotel early Monday afternoon after almost a day of the release of the video in which he admitted the leaks that have exposed the massive collection of Americans' telephone records, the PRISM program that intercepts internet traffic, and there are other issues that Ed Snowden is ready to leak about. He told the South China Morning Post, the English language newspaper in Hong Kong, that he is still in that international city. He said, "People who think I made a mistake in picking Hong Kong as a location misunderstand my intentions. I am not here to hide from justice. I am here to reveal criminality." Now, the other important item that's been released and attributed to Ed Snowden is the top-secret White House memo regarding cyber warfare. And that's his focus and the reason he chose Hong Kong, it appears. He said that the U.S. surveillance program has hacked into hundreds of computers in Hong Kong and China since 2009. "We hack network backbones," he said, "like huge internet routers, basically, that give us access to the communications of hundreds of thousands of computers without having to hack every single one." Now, that's the real story here. And I printed out the latest dispatch from the New York Times, which runs almost 4 pages, printed out on 8.5 by 11 paper, so it's somewhere around 1,500 words long. And that's the only reference to the critical issue that he's trying to draw attention to by leaving himself as a target for arrest and then extradition from Hong Kong. And you have to go to the Guardian newspaper in London to get more on his revelations about hacking of Hong Kong and China. He claims that we've been doing it since 2009. He accused the U.S. of bullying the Hong Kong territory because it didn't want local authorities to learn of America's cyber activities. He's quoted by the South China Morning Post, "I'm neither traitor nor hero, I'm an American." He says, "We've hacked hundreds of targets in Hong Kong, including public officials, a university, businesses, students, and on the mainland too. These were part of more than 61,000 NSA hacking operations globally," he said. Now, he gave a document, still undefined, to the South China Morning Post, and they haven't published it yet. They said they're still working to verify it. He said, "We hack network backbones like huge internet routers." He said he was releasing the information to demonstrate the hypocrisy of the U.S. government when it claims that it does not target civilian infrastructure, unlike its adversaries. And this is crucial support for some speculation that I've been offering here. I've been ranting about cyber warfare for a while now. I think it's very dangerous, and that it's an act of war just like bombing a country or invading it, putting boots on the ground, as we say. And yet the American media plays it as the United States is always a victim of hacking, of cyber warfare. And I believe we are a victim, but it's blowback from our own aggressive actions. And Ed Snowden is exposing them. 61,000 NSA hacking operations globally. That's not solely for defensive purposes. And the guy who is in charge of both the NSA and the Pentagon's cyber warfare unit is General Keith Alexander. The idea that he holds both of those jobs is somehow not seen as odd or unusual in Washington. But I think it is. Keith Alexander was testifying on Capitol Hill today before the Senate Appropriations Committee. And like other officials who are defending the unconstitutional surveillance of Americans by our government, he's trying to divert our attention from the unconstitutional behavior and the illegal actions of our government by talking about the outcome. The end that justifies these unjustifiable means. And without any specification, he said, well, these programs have played a critical role in thwarting dozens of terrorist attacks aimed at U.S. targets and abroad. Now, you hear that? Dozens in the U.S. and abroad. We have no idea if those numbers are accurate or reflect objective cases at all. We just have to trust these people because, of course, they've got the secrets we don't. And that's the cat and mouse game that they play. Now, interestingly, the one case that General Alexander did talk about publicly that is making the rounds in Washington is the case of Najibullah Zazi, an Afghan-American. You remember he was in Colorado, and they traced him across the country. He pled guilty to planning suicide attacks in New York. And while it does appear that this is one of the rare instances of a domestic terrorism case that wasn't ginned up by the FBI by an inserted paid informant or provocateur, even the state Associated Press says, excuse me here. Here's the quote. But in the rush to defend the surveillance programs, government officials have changed their stories and misstated key facts of the Zazi plot. And they've left out one important detail. The email that disrupted the plan could easily have been intercepted without PRISM. Even before the surveillance laws of 2007 and 8, the FBI had the authority to and did regularly monitor email accounts linked to terrorists. The only difference was, before the laws changed, the government needed a warrant. Now, we've been told that if the data mining of our phone records leads to information and they want to actually listen to a phone call, they have to go back to court and get a different warrant, a specific warrant. That's what they tell us. But Ed Snowden makes it clear that he didn't get warrants when he wanted to listen in from his desktop in Honolulu. And I have no evidence, and that doesn't mean that there wasn't a warrant, a separate warrant in the Zazi case, but they haven't trotted out any evidence that they went back to court and got a follow-up warrant specific to Zazi before they tracked him from Denver across the country and then picked him up and arrested him. And so I would tend to believe that a massive dragnet like the one we've been subjected to would, in fact, bust up some attempted terrorist events. That's not the point. I hope you're not tired of hearing me say this, but all of our elected officials and appointed officials take an oath to defend the Constitution, not to protect the American people. Their highest priority, their highest obligation, is to protect and defend the Constitution. And they've already trampled it, and they're saying it was okay because they did it to keep us safe. And one of the chief apologists is California Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Intelligence Committee. Front page story in today's San Francisco Chronicle, and credit to Carolyn Lockhead. She interviewed Feinstein, who opens up with an emotional replay of September 11th. She said it had a profound impact on her, watching on television people jumping from the burning Trade Center. Quote, she will never forget the sound of their bodies hitting the canopy down below. Matter of fact, I even have nightmares about it, says Senator Feinstein. But she doesn't seem to have any nightmares about the thousands of innocent people who've been killed by American drone strikes. And she wants us all to trust her. And I've known Dianne Feinstein since she was mayor of San Francisco in the 1980s. She's a wealthy woman with a sense of entitlement, married to a mega millionaire, Richard Blum, whose corporate interests have benefited from the war in Iraq and other expansions of the intelligence and military units of our government. And she's always been a law and order type, very much out of step with San Francisco. And so she says that when she took over as chair of the Intelligence Committee in 2009, her goal was to see that the Bush years were over and that the law prevailed and what we did was legal. But Senator, what you did was what Bush did. You redefined terms. You massaged the way things are perceived. And you papered over with the FISA law that was rammed through and renewed at the end of last year that immunized the phone companies and prevented any meaningful constitutional challenge to these unconstitutional programs. And then they turn around and say, well, the courts have approved all of them. The reason that is bullshit is that these are not adversarial proceedings before the FISA court. It's a secret government request for a secret warrant approved by a secret court in secret. And to claim that that is oversight renders the term meaningless. Now, this article points out that Dianne Feinstein deserves a little bit of credit because she has attempted to clarify the detention clause of the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act that we've talked about many times here on this program. She tried to introduce a bill to roll back the provisions that could envelop an American citizen. But she was unsuccessful, and that moment of constitutional clarity does not in any way absolve her from all of the other incursions that she's responsible for. Have you heard of Operation Urban Shield? It's underway in Boston today. It involves a mock terrorist group called Free America Citizens, who use backpack bombs. And this is a drill. But it is eerily similar to the events of April 15th. We're still trying to find out about Kraft International. The paid security agents, some might call them mercenaries, who appeared on the scene and interacted easily with FBI agents after the bombs went off. Now, I'm not prepared to draw any conclusions, but you deserve to know, and the corporate media is unlikely to tell you, that these kinds of war games that just coincidentally are strikingly similar to events that are reported as real events in the media, well, it's not the first time this has happened. You know that there were war games on September 11th, 2001. And when the FAA was contacted, they said, is this a game or is this real world? And because there are so many other inconsistencies with the story of the events in Boston on April 15th, this is just another factoid you must file away. I'll bet it will resurface. Bradley Manning continues on trial at Fort Meade, Maryland. Interesting testimony today from Army computer crimes investigator Mark Johnson. One of the critical issues that has come up is the exact dates of when Bradley Manning fed information to WikiLeaks. There is a dispute based on the testimony and cross-examination presented so far. That could be helpful to the Manning defense, we shall see. But what's really interesting is that there were some written stipulations entered into evidence in the court. One of them, from Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Martin Nehring, said his review of battlefield reports revealed that Bradley Manning's exposures revealed techniques for neutralizing improvised explosives, the name of an enemy target, the names of criminal suspects, and troop movements. And here's something very interesting. They're also trying to present evidence that one of the videos that Bradley Manning is accused of leaking, which WikiLeaks never published, somehow aided the enemy. And it relates to an airstrike in Afghanistan in the Farah province in 2009. Hopefully the judge will be able to sift through that kind of disinformation as she continues to review the testimony and evidence in the Manning court-martial case. In Russia yesterday, they essentially outlawed gays. A bill that stigmatizes Russia's gay community and bans the distribution of information about homosexuality to children was passed 436-0 in the lower house of the parliament, the Duma. The bill bans propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations. Needs to be passed by the upper house and signed by Vladimir Putin, but neither step is in doubt. And this is a fascinating retrograde effort to say that Russia can separate itself from the movement for marriage equality that is sweeping the world. France, Britain, maybe the United States, we'll find out from the Supreme Court here in the next few weeks. But it's amazing that they think they can suppress gay individuals and punish them for publishing information about being gay. And over at the homophobic center of Italy, Vatican City, it's fascinating to hear that the new Pope Francis I has acknowledged what he called a gay lobby operating inside the Vatican. Now, this is fascinating and contradictory. First of all, it's refreshing that the Pope is willing to say this. It was in a private conversation that has leaked. But it's true. And the last Pope, Benedict, appeared unable to control the gay lobby. And even as the Catholic Church has been engaging in hack politics with propaganda in the United States and elsewhere, raising hysterical arguments against marriage equality and fundamental rights for gay and lesbian persons, there is this internal struggle with a lot of closeted gays who have Roman collars, and fancy robes, powerful insiders in the Roman Catholic Church. The hypocrisy is just staggering. In Turkey, the Prime Minister Erdogan has ordered his interior minister to end all anti-government protests within 24 hours. So this is a massive effort at repression. 30,000 people were rousted from Taksim Square yesterday. And as I mentioned, the Prime Minister first said he was going to meet with some of the people, and apparently he did, but demonstrators don't believe this was a representative group. And then he turned on them and ordered that they be shut down. Will they go quietly into the night in Istanbul and around Turkey? We'll be watching. And finally today, the Obama White House has some explaining to do, because since he was safely reelected, the president has felt more comfortable talking about climate change and how to reduce our carbon emissions. In his State of the Union message, he mustered some pretty strong comments. He hasn't done much since. And of course, environmentalists have made the Keystone XL pipeline an important litmus test of his real loyalties. But it turns out the White House has been blocking several regulations from the Department of Energy. For example, to require that appliances, lighting, and buildings use less energy and create less global warming pollution. The White House has bypassed a 1993 executive order that demands that it act on proposed regulations within 90 days and has spent as long as 2 years reviewing some of the energy efficiency rules. And the blocking of the rules has frustrated congressional Democrats and enviro advocates. And it's well-deserved. I mean, Cass Sunstein was over at the White House to pick and choose which regulations were politically palatable, but he's been gone for over a year. Like I say, the White House has some splaining to do. Thanks for joining me for my news and comment. This is the free podcast, and you're authorized to wing it all around the world, even to Ed Snowden in Hong Kong.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you.